Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about elephant psychology with Dr. Gay Bradshaw, author of Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. We'll discuss the psychological health of abused and traumatized elephants and what can be done to help them. Dr. Bradshaw first observed behavior akin to post-traumatic stress disorder in elephants in the 1990s. She was in South Africa working on a project to reintroduce lions when she received reports of young male elephants attacking and killing rhinoceros, in what ultimately resulted in the death of over 100 rhinos. After returning from South Africa, she began to delve into what was going on and discovered a wide-scale pattern of aberrant behavior that ranged from elephant attacks on humans to male-on-male violence among elephants to mother elephants neglecting their young. None of these behaviors was typical of elephants, but all were correlated with some sort of extreme stress. She notes that elephants are traumatized by a number of different kinds of events, including mass slaughter due to culling, which Bradshaw calls genocide, translocation to repopulate new areas, which she notes is akin to deportation, captivity, and the breakdown of elephant society caused by poaching and massive hunting where the largest and dominant elephants are targeted. She notes that elephants are comparable mentally and emotionally to humans, and like humans, elephants, as well as other species, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Gay Bradshaw is executive director of the Kurulos Center. She holds doctorate degrees in ecology and psychology and has published, taught, and lectured widely in these fields, both in the United States and internationally. Her work focuses on the theory and methods for the study and care of animal psychological well-being and multi-species cultures. Her research expertise includes the effects of violence on and trauma recovery by elephants, grizzly bears, chimpanzees, and parrots, as well as other species in captivity. She's also established the new field of transspecies psychology, upon which the work and principles of the Kurulos Center are based. Her research has been featured in diverse media, including the New York Times, Time Magazine, National Geographic, Smithsonian, the London Times, ABC's 2020, and several documentary films. Her book, Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity, published by Yale University Press, provides an in-depth psychological portrait of elephants in captivity and in the wild. This book discusses her discovery of post-traumatic stress disorder in free-ranging African elephants and how that, combined with existing knowledge about elephant society, provides scientific justification for considering the mental, emotional, and social well-being of elephants in conservation design and policy. When I spoke to her recently, I asked Gay what started her looking at trauma and elephants.
Well, it started really subconsciously when I first visited Africa in the early 90s. And I came across a group of lions. I was with a group of other scientists, and we were looking at this sort of broad-scale project that South Africa was engaged in, which was reintroducing lions from all parts of Africa to South Africa. Most of the reserves and parks in South Africa were somewhat depleted by the Big Five wildlife. And so they were bringing in different kinds of species to stock the parks and these new eco centers that were starting to develop after post-apartheid, I should say. And there was a number of different kinds of odd behaviors and strange diseases that were cropping up. So I was there with the National Science Foundation project to really look at what was going on in terms of a large-scale landscape reintroduction program. So we began looking at lions, and during the course of that study, we came across this very unusual event, which was these elephants at the park in South Africa had been identified as the likely suspects of killing over 100 rhinoceroses. Now, that occurred over a 10-year period, but there was a spree of unusual, unprecedented deaths of rhinoceros that had obviously been killed by someone else. And at first, no one knew who they were or who the culprit was as such. But it was revealed, and it was actually recorded by a tourist, that these were young bull elephants who had been part of this large-scale reintroductory program. So what got me started on it was, at the time, there really wasn't any kind of explanation for this bizarre behavior. And bizarre meaning that it did not conform to any of the existing theories that came from ethology, what people understood to be normative or typical behavior in elephants. So I, after returning, I started to delve into what was going on. I started talking to scientists and veterinarians and other seasoned people around the world who work with elephants, and I discovered that there really was a wide-scale pattern of this so-called aberrant or unprecedented behavior. And at the time, I was doing a lot of research in psychology and neurosciences, and that's when I started to put the pieces of the puzzle together and understand that their behavior was really grounded in their experience of trauma.
So when you say trauma, what kinds of trauma do elephants go through?
Well, we're talking about now recent phenomena. When I say recent phenomena, what we're seeing in terms of the kind of symptoms of elephants, let me just describe that. For example, in these young males, bull elephants, they were killing rhinoceroses. Now, elephants, that's extremely rare, if not, doesn't happen at all. In other parks, in Addo National Park in South Africa, the males, young bulls, were killing each other. The rate of 90% mortality of the male elephants was due to male-on-male fighting. Again, unprecedented in the wild, where you're looking at places like Kenya and Amboseli, where over decades this behavior has not been observed. In India, for example, the number and types of quote-unquote elephant attacks on humans had increased dramatically. So those are the kinds of symptoms. The trauma then were, when you map those kinds of symptoms and behavior, they're correlated with the extreme stress and disruptive events that elephant society has been sustaining over the last few hundred years, which has been coincident with and caused by European colonization of Africa and Asia. So the trauma specifically are these disruptive events, which is having to do with mass slaughter. If these were humans, we would call it genocide, deportation, which we call for animals, translocation, moving them from one place to another, again, as I described, in an effort to repopulate areas where the species has gone extinct. Then there are things like the breakdown of elephant society, which has been caused by poaching and massive hunting, where typically the larger elephants are being killed, so elephant society no longer has the classic type of the hierarchical structure that it has had for millennia. So the trauma essentially is killing and habitat destruction, fragmentation, which translates to profound psychological and physiological stress, which we call trauma.
The behaviors and symptoms that you were seeing, that were occurring, these aberrant behaviors and symptoms, was it primarily in young bull males, or was it across the spectrum?
Well, at the time, and this was what was significant and made it scientifically plausible, is that these types of events had been observed in the whole suite of different kinds of aberrant behavior and psychological symptoms had been observed, but they were what we would call anecdotal. In other words, they hadn't been collated in a particular comprehensive way. The young bulls was significant because it was statistically significant. That is to say, they killed over 100 rhinoceroses. So that was something that was a statistic that was very robust. After my identification and pulling the pieces together and understanding that their behavior was a psychological disorder that was caused by these different kinds of traumatic events, then other kinds of incidents started to rise up or started to be recognized as part of this general syndrome. For example, Mark and Delia Owens, who are researchers in Africa, noticed in Zambia that mothers, young mothers, were neglecting their young. They also displayed an exhibited behavior, asocial behavior to each other. Now, that is completely atypical for elephants. Elephants are very family-oriented. The mothers take care of their babies. If the baby is distressed, the mother immediately goes over, or another allomother, that is to say, another helping mother, which is part of their family unit. They're very, very tightly knit society. They're very affectionate. They're very caring. Asocial is just not a word, not a descriptor that you associate with an elephant. So initially, yes, it was associated with the male young bulls. But when we stepped back and looked at and talked to other people and started collating other kinds of data, we find that it's across the generations and across gender and across continents.
Tell me what a normal social structure is for an elephant. They're not asocial, which you were just saying, but, you know, what is the normal hierarchy?
What we would call the sort of the fundamental unit of elephant society is the family. And that is made up of female, there's a mother, there's a matriarch. There are allomothers, which are females, aunties is a more colloquial expression, and young female and male elephant babies. And essentially, that's a family unit where there's sort of a shared caregiving of the babies, and the females and males stay within the family unit. The females continue to. The young males, when they're between 8 or 9, 10, around that age, they leave the family unit and join the all-bull group or area, that is to say where these older bulls are, and they basically, the young bulls, enter in a second phase of socialization where they learn about how to be a bull. And so elephant society, you can think of it as sort of a mosaic or a complex web of all of these interacting family units that once historically stretched across the continent. Now, a number of researchers have been looking at various levels in terms of the organization of elephant society. So the family unit is what we would call like the atom of elephant society. But there's all these other levels of associations and constellations of different groupings. So there'll be different, in the next layer, there'll be a sort of a constellation of family units and beyond that. So you really, when you look at elephant society, you have to understand that it has tremendous verticality. That is to say, there's a lot of organization that's not just between family units, but then clusters of family units are associated with other clusters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like a multi-layered cake. And so when we really look at what has happened over the last 500 years with European colonization, you had a radical change in terms of human indigenous cultures, a radical change in terms of how the landscape was affected, and elephant society sustained tremendous mortality. You really have seen the succession of severe traumatic events. And again, if we were talking about humans, we would be comfortable in talking about, you know, mass killings and genocide, where you have essentially the culture, the fundamental fabric of the society and the culture has broken down. So when we see such radical departures from normative behavior in these young bulls that are, and the young females, what we really are seeing is the accumulation, not only their individual experiences, but also the accumulation of a devastating toll on elephant society over hundreds of years.
How do babies learn from their elders? And is this trauma translated from elders to babies, or is it more through the structure and behavior of how elephant families are acting?
What is important to realize is what we understand about human society, human brains, and human behavior and psychology, we can really translate to other species. And that's really what's significant, is that the elephants in this particular case, the neurobiology, the neuroscience is all there and understood. What the behavior and the symptoms of these elephants really did is they gave very, very concrete empirical evidence that animal societies function very similarly to human societies, and that is to say that they are psychologically, neurobiologically vulnerable to disturbance and trauma, just as our human societies who have sustained genocide, war, and other kinds of violence. Now, what we know about the animal brain, and this is common to all vertebrates, that is including fish, although it has not been documented to the level that we have with the elephants and chimpanzees and parrots, other species like that, is that they all neurobiologically are susceptible to these kinds of stressful events. And they're learning both in terms of how to become an elephant and their susceptibility to trauma and stress is communicated neurobiologically and what we would call through, you know, teaching. So in other words, our whole model of how we learn and what we understand, how we grow up, has to be understood as having at functioning at the neurological level as well as sort of in terms of learning and copying behavior, you might call it that. So trauma and stress, just like culture, is transmitted from one to another and across generations. So what you're seeing, for example, is the young mother who's neglecting her baby. Is she herself is responding, has been traumatized neurobiologically, they talk about it being etched into the brain, is that it creates a dysfunction of normative behavior. In other words, there's someone who's traumatized, just like we see someone who has gone through a war. They are psychologically damaged and wounded. Same with that young, with the young female, who probably either saw her family killed or she was raised in a family unit that was not a normal family unit. So in other words, you're losing tradition. You're having stressed mothers taking care of stressed babies. And you get this cascade effect where essentially, and what's very, very disturbing, is that elephant culture, elephant society itself is changing because of the environment and what they've experienced that has been human caused.
In the past, animal studies were used to really make inferences about human behavior, and here studies of human response to trauma can help understand how it's affecting elephant culture.
Yes, in fact, essentially science has been built on what I called a unidirectional inference. That is to say, it's a typical protocol or routine within science to use animals, as you described, as quote-unquote models for human biology and human psychology, even neuropsychology. However, it has not been considered scientifically valid to take inferences from humans to other animals. That is to say, a bidirectional inference. However, now, with the neuroscience's new models, there is a unitary model of brain, behavior, and psychology for all vertebrates. So essentially, we have this bidirectional inference. What we learn about elephants, we can apply to humans. What we learn about humans, we can apply to parrots, back and forth and back and forth. That's not to say that there aren't differences, but species differences really have been leveled to the status of what we would call human cultural differences. So essentially, what we're seeing is, it's no surprise, we're seeing elephants mirroring what has happened in human society, indigenous human society. In all of these locations where elephants are living and undergoing this incredible kind of violence and stress, the same thing has happened to the local human populations who are also expressing very similar kinds of symptoms. So we understand, it's just no leap of the imagination, why there is reticence and has been resistance is because the implications are not scientific, they're political. If we now understand, which is what science has documented and is now sort of forced to admit, that humans and animals are not that different in fundamental ways that we have used to really define what we consider to be uniquely human, that has huge political ramifications in terms of how we live our life. We've been able to rationalize the exploitation of animals. We've been able to rationalize even conservation that uses culls, mass killings, translocations, which is deportations, breaking up animals, elephant society, and lions and other animals. All of these different kinds of manipulative measures in the name of conservation, we've been able to rationalize it because we said they don't have emotions, they don't have minds, they don't have the same kind of susceptibility that humans have to these kinds of things. That is to say, we are able to do things ethically to animals that we cannot do to humans because animals lack those qualities that we humans have. Now science has erased that. They said, uh-uh. Science has now said all of those qualities that we have used to distinguish ourselves from other species that allows us to exploit them, we find out that animals have them. So the resistance comes from the implications of what this actually means, that essentially an elephant, a parrot, or a fish is really no different than a human. And in essentially, as I say, that the fundamental identity transcends form. What we consider to be quintessentially human, when I say we, I'm talking about a very specific human political system. We call it the Western, modern, however you want to call it, the Cartesian. Our present dominant science-based episteme, knowledge system, belief system, is based on the fact that we've said that animals are quote-unquote lower than us. The science now completely overturns it by erasing that artificial barrier.
Some of that is what you're referring to as things like self-identity.
Yes.
And emotions.
Yes, culture, grieving, mourning, intelligence, tool use, a whole suite of different kinds of attributes and characteristics.
Going back to the events that you were saying could lead to post-traumatic stress disorder,
yes.
And you, in your book, Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity, and numerous articles that you've written in Nature and elsewhere, you've talked about sort of four main categories, captivity, physical abuse, isolation, and witnessing the loss or death of loved ones.
Yes.
Are those the main? Are there others? Start with that.
Well, PTSD is formally post-traumatic stress disorder, is a categorization that is formally defined by psychologists. In the what they call the DSM-4, it's what psychiatrists and psychologists, a manual that they go to classify a particular suite of symptoms that someone may be exhibiting. So post-traumatic stress disorder is a very formalized way, and elephants, in terms of the elephants who are showing these different kinds of behavior, conform, strictly speaking, to being candidates for post-traumatic stress disorder. Now,
so the suite of symptoms includes
witnessing. Technically, when people witness someone, they feel life threatening, either themselves or someone that they care for, or intimate with, or they're close to. They witness a threat, life threatening event, or the actual death. Can bring on post-traumatic stress disorder. That's, for example, why you had all sorts of degrees, if you want to call it that, or different kinds of shades of trauma-related and post-traumatic stress symptoms that are associated with events such as 9/11, genocide, even something like a bank holdup, all of these kinds of things. So essentially, when there is something which is perceived, it doesn't have to be actually happening in the sense of that you don't have to see someone be killed. But if there is this sense of perception of a life-threatening event to yourself or someone you're close to, then that person is a candidate for PTSD. In the case of the elephants, they are culls. These young babies, for example, the young bulls, witnessed from helicopters shooting their families down. They saw their families hacked. They were babies, they're 2 years old, so they lost their whole family. Tremendous violence, tremendous noise. They were dragged and tethered into a cart. When you look at the photographs, it's very disturbing. You see their eyes bugging out. When you look at, for example, elephant young babies in zoos, you also see that. You see these, you know, you see terror. You see them carted into trucks. These elephants, for example, the young bulls that killed the rhinoceroses, were moved to completely new areas. They did not have a family that or a social system that would buffer, that would help in trauma recovery. They had to fend on their own. And they didn't have that second phase of socialization with older bulls. So in other words, the whole learning, caring, loving family system, which makes an elephant who an elephant is, was gone. On top of that, having the terror of the violence that they saw done to their family as well as themselves.
And so that also goes for poaching or hunting, where the top elephants are killed as well.
Yes, and there are a lot of traditional knowledge. They call it loss of socio-ecological knowledge. There's a lot of how to be an elephant, what it means. We have to, you know, really understand this is one of the things that I think is most difficult for a lot of people today, is that our society is very different than traditional indigenous societies. In traditional indigenous societies, of which elephant is one, and then there's humans, American Indians, etc., was a very strong, coherent, collective-based society. And the traditions are passed on. There are not these disruptive kinds of events. Our lifestyle today is radically different than traditional indigenous societies that were place-based, that had continuity, that there were several generations within the community. Learning and teaching and caregiving was distributed and is distributed among a larger community, as well as profound knowledge and connection with what we call quote-unquote nature. Our modern society is, we live in boxes. We call nature other. We have a sense of separation, which we are now seeing the tremendous cost of what it has meant to see ourselves as separate and to make ourselves separate from quote-unquote other nature. So what we are seeing as sort of an epidemic in modern societies with suicide of young people, all kinds of different types of psychological disorders, bullying, all of these different kinds of behaviors are symptomatic of the way we live and the violence that has been sustained and continues to be sustained. And the most disturbing thing is we're seeing that in animal societies. It's not just elephants. We're seeing it in cougars. We're seeing it in orcas. We're seeing it in dolphins, which have these very, very, which are indigenous cultures, just like we see in indigenous cultures all over the world. I gave a talk recently where I described a tribe in Colombia, the Nukak tribe, and I think it was 1988, 18 years after the first contact with outsiders. Over half the population of the Nukak tribe had perished because of not only disease, but suicide. I mean, that kind of understanding is very disturbing because of what it says about us. When I'm saying us, I'm talking about modern humanity or this particular social, political, and economic agenda that we associate with modernity. So what we're seeing in elephants, what we're seeing in other wildlife, has been happening to indigenous peoples all over the world.
Can you describe some of what you've seen in cougars and dolphins and some of the other species as well?
Well, I haven't seen it. Well, actually, I have in terms of some personal experiences with bears. I have not seen it with cougars. It's, like I mentioned earlier, now that this whole, and it's not just my work, there's a huge body, starting with Darwin or even before, talking about animal emotions and animal psyche. Now that there is this sort of acceptance that animals have a mind and emotions that is susceptible to trauma and stress, people are starting to reframe and starting to see their observations from the field in a different light. So, for example, a number of researchers from University of Washington and others in Arizona have been seeing what they call, you know, odd behavior in young adolescent or young male cougars, where they're seeing them doing things and acting in ways which are very, very different than quote-unquote traditional ways because of the same breakdown. The dolphins has been observed off California, where the dolphins are killing porpoises. They, you know, call them killer dolphins. Very disturbing. The whole image of a dolphin is very, very, you know, loving and very positive and things like that. They are actually killing. And a number of different kinds of hypotheses are put forward that it's an environmental toxin, et cetera. All of those are perfectly plausible. However, the most parsimonious explanation is that they are undergoing a social collapse through indirect, direct, either psychologically or physiologically or socially, however you want to look at it, because of the violence that has been meted out to them by humanity. That is to say, hunting, loss of fisheries, pollution is one that's indirect. But we cannot just ascribe these changes in behavior to saying, oh, it's an environmental pollutant. Because if you look at the decades and decades and decades of research on elephants, dolphins, and other social creatures, that is the defining characteristic is their culture, is their society, and that has been broken down by direct mortality through hunting, overfishing, whatever you call it, poaching, as well as the disruption of their habitat, which has both indirect and direct effects on them psychophysiologically.
So what makes, say, an elephant turn aggressive instead of, you know, and turns in, or a dolphin turn into a killer dolphin instead of trying to harm themselves or becoming depressed?
Well, I don't think there's an either or. I think that, you know, just like with humans, we have to understand that each individual is unique. Each community is unique. The circumstances are, and there's going to be diverse expressions. Depression is related to asociality. If you go to zoos, for example, you do have self-mutilation, self-injury of elephants and other wildlife. You have what they call stereotypy, which is a sort of pacing or repetitive behavior that has been called, you know, that it's not purposeful. Well, it has a purpose. Basically, it is essentially a psychological coping mechanism for the terrible trauma of being in captivity, which is essentially being under threat all the time. We see the same things in human prisoners, whether they're political prisoners or concentration camp prisoners, etc. Some individuals react by self-mutilation. Some become depressed. Some, like elephants and other wildlife in captivity, actually perform infanticide. They kill their babies. So just as we are sort of intrigued with the multiplicity and the, you know, diversity and the different kinds of, you know, sort of mysteries of the mind and the psyche and the soul, we must understand in terms of other animals. So what makes them respond one or the other? Well, for example, you have to look at things as a case specific. In the elephants that I described with rhinoceroses, who killed the rhinoceroses, you can very simply understand that their endocrinal, their neuroendocrinal pathways were disrupted. That is to say, their normal developmental progress was disrupted. Their learning process and also their biological processes, neuropsychological, neurobiological, neuroendocrinal processes were disrupted by the kinds of experiences that they had. Therefore, when they were going perhaps into must, which is when they start to become sexually mature, these bulls were becoming sexually mature years before they normally do in more normal in historic times. Then you can explain their aggression by some kind of mixed signal. I wrote a paper about that, is that you can talk about it from the perspective of that there's some sort of, there was some pheromone that their circuitry, because their brain circuitry was messed up by this non-normative development, misinterpreted the signal, and so they killed the rhinoceros. Or you can explain it in terms of, you know, what they call hyperaggression, as being in defensive mode all the time. those are all useful, but, you know, and all of them may be true for one, or for one person, or for, you know, the whole set of the elephants. What is most important is to understand what incredible trauma and violence and disruption that these individuals and society have sustained that caused them, that cultivate this kind of atypical behavior, and it's distressed behavior. So what makes one depressed or another? It's having to do with the circumstances. For example, parrots, there's a certain, the Moluccan cockatoos, in captivity are notorious as a species for self-mutilation, which often proves fatal. Now, why do they have that propensity for that particular kind of symptom in response to trauma, as opposed to, say, an Amazon or an elephant that does self-mutilation at a statistically lower level? At least that's what's assumed. That's difficult to ascertain, and it's not known. But again, what's most important and what's most horrifying is we're causing this profound distress.
Are there ways to treat it? Can you rehabilitate a, you know, traumatized elephant?
Again, that's a complicated thing. It's a yes and no. So I'll try to kind of weave that through. For example, we'll take an example. The little babies that, in contrast to the young bulls that saw their family killed and then were shipped to another park without any kind of mothering, without any kind of care and trauma recovery treatment. In contrast to them, we look at the baby elephants that Dame Daphne Sheldrick, who's outside of Kenya, has an orphanage, and for decades she's been taking these babies in. And if you follow her babies, she keeps them for 10 years, she recreates elephant society. For 10 years, they're reintroduced gradually and then eventually to the wild herds with very positive results. They are happy and healthy, and they are very critically, which is very important to understand, is they're able to rejoin the wild herds. Now, that doesn't say that there not may not be a reoccurrence. There might be a triggered event, because like with people with PTSD and trauma-related things, the trauma is profound and actually changes and etches in, as I said earlier, etches into our circuitry. However, these elephants, relatively speaking, have not gone out to kill rhinoceroses. They haven't gone out to do different kinds of, they haven't been observed at being depressed. And the reason why is because Dame Daphne recreates elephant society. She recreates the structures. However, as powerful and as wonderful as that is, she can't do it alone, because the wild herds are under extreme stress and trauma. That is to say, from poaching, from limited habitat, because the habitat has been reduced by making parks and reserves and, you know, basically cutting up the entire historic expanse of elephant land. So, yes, recovery can occur. However, there's still the potential for it to be triggered by some kind of stressful event. And the society itself is fragmented psychologically, socially, and culturally, as well as physically. So if we want to stop this, we want to basically help elephant society move off the trajectory of what is evolving in terms of this changed culture and behavior and psyche, then we have to fundamentally restore the elements that supported and created the society that we encountered 500 years ago when explorers first came, Europeans came to Africa. That means making all of Africa available to elephants. That's their natural thing. That's their natural society. From whatever way you want to look at it in science, that's the logical kind of a thing. Stop poaching. Stop hunting. Stop moving them around like chess pieces. Basically, conservation is, by the science that we now know about the brain, is transformed from a movement of preservation to one of wildlife self-determination. In other words, our role as scientists in society is to support and restore their culture and do that in any kind of way. So, long story made short, yes, trauma recovery is possible, But when we look at longitudinal records in terms of looking at concentration camp victims and others who have sustained severe trauma, which is very much in parallel from the brain perspective, from the culture perspective, et cetera, it's very difficult to eradicate. It may take successive generations in order for the society to really begin anew. And that means not having more violence. But you can't just turn it on and off. And that's the real strong lesson of traumatology and neurobiology. Now, for other individuals, take Carol Buckley, who is the founder of the Elephant AIDS International and co-founder of the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, which is world famous for its ability to help heal adult elephants who have been kept in zoos and circuses. Now, these are different age than an experience than what Daphne takes with her babies. But most of these elephants were either wild-caught as babies and terribly traumatized, or they were captive-bred. In other words, they were still they still sustained tremendous trauma. Now, Carol has been able to do tremendous recovery work with these individuals. But also, as I write about in my book and various articles, they retain certain kinds of behaviors and symptoms of trauma. For example, they have a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful sanctuary, and they are supported. They are given physical and emotional support. They're with other elephants. They're able to be an elephant again. However, some individuals, despite the expanse that they have, when they encounter a fence, again, sanctuary is still captivity. However, when they encounter the fence, they start this what they call the stereotypic swaying and bobbing, just like they used to do when they were in the circus, just like they used to do in the zoo. In other words, the presence of the fence triggers, and they basically go back to where they were. So trauma is pernicious. Is recovery possible? Yes, it is. But it takes a fundamental commitment to not only helping the elephants, but changing ourselves so that we create an environment that deters any of these kind of violence happening again and is totally nurturing and supportive of a recreation of their society.
So taking elephants in zoos and circuses, currently there are perhaps around 600 elephants in the U.S. in captivity. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so how should people react to seeing the elephants in zoos? Are they cared for well? I mean, I guess you have two issues, you know, treatment in zoos, accredited zoos, and you also have circuses, and then you have also the idea that they're physically captive, even if they're well treated.
Mm-hmm.
Would advocating for getting elephants out of zoos be a good thing? I know that's a big debate right now, and a number of zoos have, you know, are not replacing their elephants and so on and so forth.
Well, I think the conclusion is obvious. You know, I sort of leave it to the reader. The facts are from science, which is supposedly what zoos and circuses and animal behavior, et cetera, anyone to do with elephants, argues that, you know, uses science as the foundation for shaping and informing what they do, their practices. From the perspective of science, what have we found out? One, we found out that elephants and humans are comparable. All animals, humans included, are comparable mentally and emotionally. They are also susceptible to the same things that humans are in terms of psychologically and emotionally that cause disturbances, which has to do with experiencing violence and also things which also is inclusive of captivity. If we understand that really, in essence, animals and humans are, you know, kin under skin, as I call it, in the sense of that the essence of who that person is and how they function is comparable, then what we understand about the ethics of forced human captivity and imposing violence on humans needs to be translated to other animals. And all of the data is there. All the evidence is there. You know, captive industry openly acknowledges stereotypy, this repeated behavior. Stereotypy is understood to be a deeply psychologically distressing behavior. So essentially, we're really confronted with the ethics, the implication. If our knowledge system, science, and I would say our own intuition, tells us that keeping someone in captivity, no matter who the species is, against their will, is wrong, then, and detrimental, then ethically, I think that we are compelled to make a change. It's a kind of an inconsistency. In other words, we're really what we call a paradigm shift, is that we were able to justify and rationalize a certain kind of practice by keeping, using animals and relating to them in certain ways. Now that that scientific rationale has changed, then we are compelled to make behavioral changes and ethical changes on our part. I think that's what's really, this is what's so earth-shattering, is because we're not just talking about a new perception. We're talking about something that reflects back to us. It's not only that we're perceiving animals different, we're starting to perceive ourselves differently, of who we are. Human identity is really being challenged, modern human identity. Now, if I emphasize, when we say human, it's very specific. We have to say this is associated with the kinds of things that animals are being subjected to. You have to associate that with particular cultures, human cultures. If you look at American Indians, they did not have zoos, did not have circuses. They did not have, industrialized food processing of animals. So really what we're being asked is saying, what are we going to do with the information that we know now? What are we going to do with what we know intuitively and with what science actually tells us? That's where society is. And I think a number of people are digesting that and understanding that in order for us to be a coherent society, in order for us to heal our own wounds, the same kinds of practices that we have used on animals, we use upon ourselves. But those need to be changed if we are going to heal as a society and if we are going to progress, which is really what our byword is that we will progress. However, progress in this sense really means returning. I refer to it as back to the garden, back to a place where we are kin. We recognize our kinship in very profound ways. We recognize that we are in equal standing with animals and vice versa. It's a joyous thing. It's absolutely fabulous. But it's going to take some work getting back there. And the time to start is now.
So in essence, because so much of human identity, who, how, what we are, has been based on what other species lack, now that's turned on its head, basically, we really need to be thinking about what it is that makes us human. Which actually leads me to a question of, in your book, Elephants on the Edge, your subtitle is What Animals Teach Us About Humanity.
Yeah.
And so what do these animals teach us about humanity?
Well, like I said, first it surely should read modern humanity or a particular, however you want to call it, European, colonial, whatever you want to call it, Western, whatever. So when we talk about that, what does it teach us? I think, like I was just saying, is that that so much of what we consider to be usual practices and part of what we have a cultural identity are, intrinsically very violent. We see that in our own within the human society, how we interact with each other and the kind of abuse and the kind of violence and the kind of psychological and physical symptoms that have resulted in the breakdown of our own social society. And I think essentially what we're understanding is that we can start to return to model the elephant. We admire the elephant. Elephant is this charismatic species. Everyone loves elephants. Everyone thinks they're so marvelous. We watch them on television. We watch them in documentaries. We see how warm they are. We see how lovely they are, how dedicated they are. We see, quote, unquote, how human an animal they are. And yet we're not making that change in terms of how we live our life so that the elephant actually can live their own life. So what this teaches us, I think it teaches us that we, as a modern society, need to make radical changes in how we live our life.
Now, your center, Can you tell me a little bit about the Kuro Center? And you also have an animal recovery and education sanctuary.
Yes.
As part of it. Can you tell me both about the center itself and the sanctuary?
Well, the Kuro Center, excuse me, the Kuro Center was founded basically to create a space. We basically have three, I'll say we have three themes. Our first theme is really looking at, it's both education and research in the saying of looking at trauma recovery of individual animals, where you have, for example, at the different sanctuaries, or you have in different locales, animals who have been taken from abusive and violent situations and are on a path to recovery. So one of our areas that we are looking at both from an education and research perspective is how do we help these individuals recover and be able to live fulfilling lives despite what they've experienced. We have working, one of our faculty members is Vera Mueller Paisner, has been working with horses specifically and dogs to look at particular techniques from psychotherapy to say, are there methods that we use for humans who have suffered trauma that we can apply to animals in an ethical way? You can't just cookie cut it because they're different. But are there kinds of things that we can do? The education part, of course, is to bring awareness to scientists, to veterinarians, to schools, to the public in general, about the animal emotions and minds, to understand their dog, their cat, the birds outside, the bear that comes into their yard is really a person having to wear, you know, a bear suit or a cat suit, and to help them understand what they might be able to do and change in their lives to make the bear or the cat and the dog have a healthy and fulfilling life like we would expect for ourselves. So one part of our three themes then is looking at psychological and emotional trauma recovery. The second theme then is really extending these ideas and this concept of trans-species psychology, which is this field that I founded to really reflect where we are scientifically in understanding of human-animal comparability in terms of mind and emotions, is extending that to conservation. So we're looking at then conservation of chimpanzees, conservation of elephants, conservation of parrots from the perspective of social justice and self-determination. So we're looking at the application of what we understand about animals from the point of view of their minds and emotions to the society, to animal cultures, wildlife cultures, and saying, what does this imply for conservation policy? What does this apply in terms of law? The third theme, then, is more directly focused in terms of human transformation, sort of the second half of the book title, What We Learn About Humanity. So that's we have a number of programs which are education-based with school children. We have things called the Trans Peace Ambassadors, which is really trying to put concretely into action the learning and the activities that starts to cultivate what we call trans-species living, that is to say a community, a society, that it does not exclude animals as equal partners, but brings animals in as partners in terms of how we live, how we make decisions, the kinds of knowledge building, very much similar and resonant with traditional indigenous subsistence living. And so here in those programs, we have another education one called Sacred Bones, where we're working with American Indian tribes and others to really bring back kind of a reconciliation, bringing in the science, our understanding about nature and animals with traditional cultures, and affecting a kind of a transformation in terms of how we live very every day in our everyday living. So our three themes, then, is really what Kuroos is about. And it's essentially we're trying to create a container to retain the diversity of ideas and the different kinds of perspectives, but with the whole point of creating sort of ethical coherency in the sense of serving animals and humans as animals. Because that's what we're doing. We're re-entering. Humans are now re-entering and understanding that we are part of the animal kingdom. So the Karula Center really has, we do education, we do research, we do service, we work with different kinds of animal organizations to help humans who are working in sanctuary, animal advocacy, et cetera, how they are, they're under a lot of stress and trauma having to witness and help these animals who are severely affected. So we work with them. How do we support humans who are transitioning from one cultural pattern of a society built on animal abuse and violence to one that is really embracing what we call trans-species and a kind of a co-living type of framework. So the Karula Center, again, it's an international organization. If you look at our faculty who are working with a number of different species in these different areas of science and conservation and education.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about elephant psychology with Dr. Gay Bradshaw, author of Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the AnimalWise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.